Men, if you've lost your hair, it doesn't mean you can't find it again. Try Hims Hair Loss Solutions and you'll be joining hundreds of thousands of subscribers who found their hair again. It can be hard for men to deal with hair loss, even though it is common. Luckily, I'm here to provide you with a solution so you don't even have to talk about it. Through Hims, you can restore your hair by accessing their personalized hair loss solutions. Men value many different things about their appearance. But if you're a guy who really cares about your hair and find that it's slowly going away, you might be feeling discouraged when you look in the mirror. And that's where Hims comes in. Check out their personalized hair loss solutions, and you can start seeing your hair grow back in as little as 3 to 6 months. Hims provides you with convenient access to a range of hair loss treatments that work, all from the comfort of your couch. Hims makes treating hair loss simple with doctor-trusted options and clinically proven ingredients, like finasteride and minoxidil that can regrow hair in as little as 3 to 6 months. Choose from personalized chewable, oral, spray, and serum treatments to find what works best for you. The process is simple and 100% online, so there are no uncomfortable doctor visits. Answer a few questions, and a medical provider will determine if treatment is right for you. If prescribed, your treatment is sent directly to you for free. No insurance is needed, and one low price covers everything from treatments to ongoing care. Hims has hundreds of thousands of trusted subscribers, and they can help you get your confidence back too with visibly thicker and fuller hair. Start your free online visit today at hims.com/Hail Mary. That's hims.com/Hail Mary for your personalized hair loss treatment options. hims.com/Hail Mary. Results may vary, based on studies of topical and oral minoxidil and finasteride. Prescription products require an online consultation with a healthcare provider who will determine if a prescription is appropriate. Restrictions apply. See website for full details and important safety information.
Ladies and gentlemen, we are now boarding Group A. Please have your boarding passes ready to scan. If your phone is cracked, old, or was chewed up by your Chihuahua travel companion, please refrain from holding up the line. And instead, simply go to Verizon and trade in any phone in any condition from one of their top brands for the new Samsung Galaxy S25 Plus with Galaxy AI on Unlimited Ultimate and a watch or tab, also on them.
Service plan required for watch or tab. Trade-in and additional terms apply. See Verizon.com for details.
At Kroger, an annual Boost membership just got even better. Now you can choose from Disney Plus with ads, Hulu with ads, or ESPN Plus on us when you sign up. Plus, enjoy unlimited free delivery, double fuel points, exclusive offers, and free items. Sign up for a Boost membership today. It's an easier way to save, including new streaming options to relax with while we deliver your groceries. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Hi, folks. Welcome to another episode of Film Study. This is Ken McCusick, and we're here to have the unhappy part of this week's review, discussing the offense from that loss over Pittsburgh. Here to do that with me is Gordon McGinnis of PFF. Gordon, how are you doing?
I'm doing as well as I think you can be doing in the circumstances, recapping this game.
Yeah, it was a tough game. Gordon, a Ravens fan, for those who don't know, also the director of content for PFF, always happy to have him on. He's one of the really good discussions you always get when I get the chance to talk to him. Lots of things went wrong here for the Ravens. Most of them on offense or special teams, turnovers, penalties, missed field goals, a controversial two-point decision we probably need to talk about, but really fine defensive effort wasted.
Yeah, I do have a slight asterisk on the defensive performance, not in the sense that I didn't think it was good this week. I thought it was good. But when I was doing some pregame analysis of this game last week, I thought this was like a potential get-right game for the Ravens defense, because where the Ravens have really struggled on defense is middle of the field. I think they're asking a lot of Roquan Smith this year. They're asking him to cover a lot of space. And Russell Wilson does not like to throw to the middle of the field. He likes to throw to the outside and challenge defensive backs downfield. So it felt like the type of game whereby the Ravens could actually have a lot more success defensively. I still think they played well, all things considered, beyond that, because they made some plays they needed to. And I think it was Roquan Smith's best game of the year so far. I'm not entirely convinced that the defense is in great shape, and I'll probably need to see them do it against a team like the game coming up against the Chargers, whereby I think they might potentially get challenged more in the middle of the field.
Right. So it's an interesting game, and we did the defense already, but now that you've just brought up the topic about Wilson not liking to go to the middle of the field, one thing we didn't see on the defense was the kind of stunt traffic that the Ravens typically have on a week-to-week basis. And it's really unusual when you completely shut down the blitz that you also completely shut down the stunts, because the usual rule is you can't call an on-field stunt when there's a blitz called on that play. And them having only two stunts the whole game tells me, or probably said, we're not stunting at all against Wilson this week. And I'm thinking part of the reason is Wilson's height and obviously some of his predilection towards not throwing in the middle of the field is a matter of he can't see it as well with bodies in the way. And I it would not surprise me if not stunting was also an attempt to not open up rush lanes and vision lanes for him in the middle of the field.
Yeah, I could see that. That would make a lot of sense.
All right. Let's see. Obviously, you know, a lot to talk about here in terms of things that were questionable. One of the things that I did not find questionable was the attempt to get a first down at the end of the half. I thought they really had to do that. You know, my immediate reaction was, oh, crap, this is not a good place to start a drive at this point in the first half, because you have to try and make a play. They chose a very safe play to get the ball into Likely's hands, and he just didn't hold on to the football, which is a very unfortunate circumstance.
Yeah, and it was a nice play made by Patrick Queen in that situation to go and win the ball there. I didn't dislike it either, and it's the type of thing I felt like they needed to try and spark the offense a little bit, and you know, with especially because they lost the possession, so the earlier fumble on the very first play, the very first drive gives away the free possession to the Steelers, mm-hmm. and they're getting the ball at the start of the second half. So there is a world whereby the Ravens get the ball, they run the ball three times, punt the ball away, they get into the half, and the Steelers get the ball at the start of the second half and go down and score, and all of a sudden you're a lot further behind. So the way the game had gone throughout the first half, I agree that they did have to, or not had to, but the sensible play was to try and mount a drive there and try and put some points on the board.
Yeah, I'll say they need a first down. I don't know that they need a drive. You can reestablish that. I mean, if Likely goes for 35, then you probably decide you want to try and get in a field goal range. If Likely, or maybe even score a touchdown. But if Likely gets 9 yards there, the Pittsburgh probably doesn't call a timeout. You know, they basically will just allow the Ravens to run. They get a first down. You probably get to the half no problem either there. I just think they need a safe play that would put them in at least first down range. If they got a first down, the half's over at all on one of the plays. You don't want to be forced to throw the ball on third down. So I thought it made sense from that. A very low risk pass they threw. I just thought strictly from a time and timeouts basis, they needed to get a first down there. They were probably looking at giving them the ball, even though Stout's been really rooting the ball, around midfield. With maybe 30 seconds to go.
Yeah.
If they lost that. So I don't think there was anything to do other than just allow the offense to run in a kind of a safest possible manner to get that time. I'm of the three turnovers, the one that bothers me more, maybe, I don't know that it bothers me more. I am very bothered by the strip interception against Hill. That it was done. Now, is it just a great play by a pretty damn good college linebacker last year and Peyton Wilson? Yeah, but what did you take away from that play?
So a little bit of an underthrow, mm-hmm. which is, you know, like that's one of those ones whereby like the interception in the sense of the turnover isn't necessarily Lamar's fault, but like the fact that it was in play is his fault. I thought all three of the turnovers were like more than a little bit unfortunate. They weren't awful plays by the Ravens. I thought the handle on the ball by Henry on the first fumble was a little bit suspect. The other two, I just, I just think were really good plays by the defense, and it's just unfortunate that it kind of happens that way sometimes.
Yeah. It'll be interesting to see, because there's two plays in this game that the Ravens have a chance to appeal to the league. By the way, you may know, what day do those appeals have to be in for the plays they want changed officially? Do you happen to know that?
No, I don't.
Okay.
No, so I don't know that, actually.
It might be Wednesday, might be Thursday, but I think it's one of those two. So the two plays, one is the interception that came off Hill. I think that the Ravens are going to try and say it was a catch and then a fumble, because I mean, he had multiple feet down, all the elements of the catch seem to be there. So I think they'll question that. And maybe that Lamar doesn't end up with that extra interception. I can see why the Ravens would want to do it, and they'd want to do it for Lamar because of the MVP voting and whatnot. And I think they will. The other is they're crazy. And it's just a complete Pittsburgh homer official scoring to rule the 1-0 a sack. That was clearly a designed run play where you got, you know, four linemen upfield already looking to block on the play, and he took off on the last sack.
Yeah. I definitely, when I saw your notes heading into this, I'd seen the same thing on that play and thought that didn't feel like a sack at the time when I saw it.
Yeah. And these are obviously neither of those is going to correct the score for 18-16 in the game. So that's we're stuck with that one. The 2-point conversion, I guess we got to talk about it. Would really like to have Henry on the field. Where do you stand on that?
Yeah, I just hated the play call for a couple of reasons. One, I think Henry has to be in the field because, like, we often, and I think the first person I heard use this was my old colleague Eric Eager. We talk about like gravity with Lamar Jackson in the sense of like what he can do and how he forces linebackers and other defensive players to. You know, just how they have to react to various different things. I think Derrick Henry has a similar thing, and I think him and Lamar Jackson are almost like force multipliers for each other. Yep. So in that situation whereby you know things are going to be kind of close quarters, just giving the defense more to think about in that situation I think is really important. The second part is like even if Henry was on the field, a play call whereby against a good defensive line that can get good push against you against the run, having a play whereby you're asking two interior offensive linemen to pull and you're asking a wide receiver and I think potentially a tight end involved. I can't exactly remember that. But to get that initial block on the edge to stop that getting out there, I just felt like you're asking so much to go right when you only really need one thing to go wrong and that play gets blown up quite easily.
I got another thing I hate about it, but Aguilar and Likely were on the left side. They had that little motion to each other, which I think people have overplayed slightly. It's just a normal kind of reaction of who has to be offline, and they're agreeing on that basically by their hand gestures. But then Nick Herbig knew exactly what to do in the play. He got straight upfield, and that destroyed the play. I mean, first of all, it's a roll left for a right-handed quarterback, and Lamar's special. He can get you out of that sometimes once in a while and reset his feet and be too quick for the defenders over there, but you're running to limited space over there, and I really hate rolling left when rolling right is so damn effective, and I would have loved to do it with Henry on the field, or even if I didn't have Henry on the field, I would have had extra elements of misdirection at the expense of size on the play. So if you want to have Keaton Mitchell on the field, or you want to run a jet sweep with Zay Flowers or whatever it might be, you got multiple ways to get that ball completed by pass or have Lamar run it in. And just they didn't have any of that going on that play. That's getting back to the gravity point.
Which is frustrating because I think that's probably one of the things that Todd Monken has done well, right? Like you mentioned the Zay Flowers thing. They've done a good job of bringing Zay Flowers in motion, using him. Either on like, you know, handing him the ball off or just using him as a decoy on those things. So in that critical situation, it was frustrating to like just set it up whereby it was like, hey, we need Lamar to go and make a play here effectively.
Yeah, man. And if you're going to do that, I mean, at least give Lamar the ease of being able to roll to his right. Because, I mean, he does two things very well. First of all, avoids that blindside bump pressure, maneuvers the pocket very well to do that. And second of all, if you give help on Watt, hopefully you can get him redirected or run himself out of the play around the pocket such that Lamar can either move up and to the right or move back and to the right, where a lot of his really magical plays have happened this year, and maybe make a play off that. I so hate forcing Lamar to roll left. I hate it more with Flacco. They had some horrible Flacco plays have been set up with trying to get him left, but Lamar is not an optimal use. And if you want the usual way of allowing Lamar to roam the line of scrimmage, looking for a direct line of sight for a throw, it's been such a good Ravens formula. I hate getting away from that in this game.
Yeah. One of those things where they potentially just like overthought themselves and wanted some kind of tendency breaker of going left instead of going right. And
yeah,
sometimes you think those things just a little too much.
Well, it changed the play apparently. And so, you know, the timeout by the Steelers really, really paid off for them there. All right. One thing I want to talk about is, you know, we've seen different teams take different approaches to try and get Lamar Jackson stopped. And one of the things the Bengals switched from 15 simulated pressures the first game. And I'm talking about 2+, by the way. If you guys have counted as 1+, it would be a different number. But 15, 2+ to 0 the second time. So I thought this was maybe a game where we'd see a lot of Steelers at the line of scrimmage try and threaten blitz consistently. And they did blitz a lot in this game, but meaning 5+. But they didn't really crowd the box in the way that I really expected. They left open the option for the Ravens to run the ball a fair amount in this game, with, you know, often 7 in the box. That is manageable, particularly with a, you know, if you have point of attack players on the field. 6 is, they're daring you to do it. 7 is, you know, you can do it with point of attack, and 8 is you probably should throw no matter what, to me.
Yeah, I think that's fair. I thought it was interesting that, like, in the passing game, it felt like the Ravens were at times on the offense, like, expecting more. Mm-hmm. And, like, they almost hesitated when they didn't get as many coming as they thought, which caused them some issues.
Completely agree. So their eligible receivers were staying in, expecting to have to set or chip, did not go. Now, with all the time Lamar had in the pocket this game, we were just talking about this in the production meeting, that should have led to some really good leak-out opportunities late. And that was one of the, I think, kind of unfortunate things that we saw in this game. But I completely agree that I think the Steelers had some false steps in the game, at least a couple that I noticed from the inside linebackers that basically froze Hill, or maybe it was even Henry on one play. But it was Hill, at least I remember once or twice, in the backfield, you know, making sure of effectively opening up the notion that his primary responsibility is to handle any blitzer and not to be a receiver on that play. It's almost like the difference between a red dog and a green dog coming from linebacker. Well, that running back has a similar and offsetting set of responsibilities, and he has to know when he can release.
Yeah, and I suspect that's probably the type of opponent you're going up against, and where the Steelers have been able to hurt teams before probably just has you probably hasn't been drilled into them of don't make those mistakes that lead to some additional pressure and things like that.
Let's talk where the Ravens are right now. They're still, if you look at DVOA, the FTN site, they've still got them with the Ravens only a slight dog to win the division. Of course, they think the Ravens are a lot better than the Steelers based on the DVOA metrics. I'm not as convinced about that, particularly right now. But other websites have the Ravens at about 1/3 to win the division. If you look at the tiebreakers, the Ravens tiebreaker situation is absolutely miserable right now. They would need for the Steelers to lose 2 of their divisional games, plus the Ravens game, but 2 of the divisional games versus Cincinnati and Cleveland, and for the Ravens, obviously, to beat Cleveland and Pittsburgh for them to be in a position where they could win the AFC North under a tiebreaker situation. Otherwise, they have to outright them. And we're at a point now in the season, we're almost too late in terms of the number of games remaining, with Pittsburgh having 5 divisional games, that there's any other reasonable set of outcomes.
Yeah, and the PFF, like, we have playoff projections built into our power rankings, and that's pretty much exactly where we have them, is 30% chance to win the division, and the Steelers at 70%, and I'm guessing mathematically the Bengals probably can still do it, but we will have that as like 0 point something, so it doesn't really show up within there. I remember I do like a very small podcast with some Scottish friends of mine, and we were talking about the Ravens Steelers game heading into it. And my takeaway going into it was that I thought the Ravens had to sweep the Steelers to have a realistic chance at winning the division, just because of some of their slip ups earlier in the season. And the Steelers, I hate using the term lucky when I think a team are also pretty good, and they've done some really good things, and I think the Steelers have, and I think they deserve to be in the position they're in. They also, like, it's over the last few weeks, they have been a little bit lucky in some of those wins. So the combination of the Ravens having games whereby a couple of plays here and there flip the result in their favor in losses, and the Steelers having a few games whereby flip things a little bit and then, you know, they lose the game, just meant that they really didn't have much room for much margin for error. So I think it's really tough to win the division unless the Steelers all of a sudden get a lot more bad luck, which it happens, right? It's a sport that when you play a 17 game regular season schedule, things that look very true in the first half of the season sometimes are very different in the final stretch because those luck elements can flip things a little bit. But it's just it's hard to see the kind of easy path to winning the division now.
Right. Right. That's unfortunately where I am. Let's talk about first of all, very quickly, are you encouraged by what the Ravens did in the secondary as in the sense that it could be a season turning positive for the Ravens?
I think so. Like I said at the top, like, caveat that I think this was an offense that they were better suited to deal with, but I liked what we saw from Tre'Davious White on the outside when he came in. One of my big frustrations this season with how the Ravens have been on defense is that not that many people realize just how good Marlon Humphrey is playing, like having one of his best seasons, like maybe even his best season in the NFL. And the Ravens have been so bad against the pass that it's like, it's not really happening. No one really cares about it. So if Tre'Davious White comes in and like is able to be like a solid contributor there, potentially even someone that takes over for Brandon Stevens down the stretch. Like, that was probably I didn't really expect White to be as good as he was because he hadn't been good in the early part of this season. Right. And it might be that this was like a good matchup for him because he was just trying to go and make some plays on the ball on some of those deep routes. But it was definitely encouraging to see them bring him in and have some success in that sense. And I also loved they were better at the safety spot, right, than they have been in previous weeks. Yeah.
And, you know, they're reducing the value of Kyle Hamilton to do it, but it clearly, the addition by subtraction, by taking Marcus Williams out of there, but I don't think Eddie Jackson will step on the field again for the Ravens, are both big plays. The Desmond King was acquired today. How significant a signing do you think that is?
It's interesting because he has had some really good seasons in the NFL and then also some ones that haven't been particularly good. Like, there was a point where, and I remember him coming into the NFL and we were really quite high on him as a draft prospect coming in to it. It's been a while since I think he was like his first couple of seasons in the NFL, I thought he was one of the best slot corners in the league. But I still think there is something there. I think last season, when he was with the Texans, he did have some really nice games in there. And I think it's a nice depth add whereby I think the Ravens are potentially thinking about like what their best grouping is at cornerback. And you could potentially see it whereby it's Marlon Humphrey spending more time on the outside, someone like Desmond King coming in on playing in the slot. And it fits in with the fact that Kyle Hamilton's role is almost certainly going to be deeper going forward, I think.
All right. Let me toss in another possibility. The Ravens currently have no option but to play the pairing of Washington and Hamilton deep, in my opinion, because Brady and Kane may be hurt, but Braid is never ready in the first place to play the back end. You know, and I think we're all in agreement on that. All right. And they don't want to have a return of Marcus Williams, I don't think, even on a alternating snaps or a, like, only in dime package kind of role, just because they don't really trust him. And my sense is that he's not really buying into the system, or he's not doing what he needs to prove he can change and play there. They'll play him there in an emergency if they have to, but they don't. They probably really do not want to. And I think King has a little bit of experience at safety. And I looked at PFF position snaps, And there was some, and it's been a few years. I think it's been 2020 was the last time he really played any safety. But I am wondering if he could be a split field guy, and maybe that's something even White could do, but he could be a split field guy in some dime packages, which will allow Hamilton to move up front again for that only. Because right now, what the Ravens played in this last game is a four corner dime. Now, I'm not opposed to that. I think, you know, a lot of ways that kind of is a good indication that you can play man defense off that, and your safeties, if they can play off that, have a really simplified set of assignments and whatnot to go with that. I just don't think you want to telegraph exactly what you're doing to the opponent with a four corner dime. And I think that's why most teams in the NFL have played a three safety, three corner dime.
I definitely think that's a possibility. And I also think, like, the timing of this move, we're not that far away from the Ravens late bye week. And if you are going to potentially make some changes there,
yeah,
like, you do get a little bit more time to go and do those things. I also, you know, because this is something we've talked about before in the past, like, when there was discussions a couple of weeks ago about does Brandon Stevens move back to safety? Mm-hmm. And, like, I just hate it as an idea, just because I think he struggles the more space he's in. Like, my long-held belief on him is that he's at his best when he can use the sideline as a little bit of a crutch. I don't think it's been a particularly good season for him, but I think when he's been at his best, is when he's able to do those things. As much as I do think he is actually, like, he has made some nice plays in his career, like coming up to play the run as kind of slot or guy in the box. But yeah, when I started seeing some stuff about, well, maybe the solution is Kyle Hamilton and Brandon Stevens at deep safety, I was like, I feel like we've tried the Brandon Stevens that safety thing several times, and it's been brought up in the summer multiple times and has never really led to anything that justified it in the NFL.
It hasn't just been the fans talking about it. The Ravens have actually started there and gone to it twice in camps. They've moved him back actually during a regular season game to play some safety either this year or last. It might have been early 23 that he did it. Maybe you remember even the game where he moved to safety on an emergency basis. Might have been one where Hamilton got ejected. The Hamilton ejection game. It might have been. He might have played some time. Oh,
was that the London game? It could have been. I can. While we're talking, right.
The point I would make about Stevens is there's certainly been safety play there before. The Ravens don't seem averse to it. Although Harbaugh said he's trying very hard to play this position, and it's not on the table to move him. What I took when I hear that entire thing, I put a comma for now on the end of it, just hearing that quote. It's like he's saying, yes, at this moment, we're not considering moving him. But I think it's going to be very soon. If they have another bad game against the pass against the Chargers, I think we could be back to the language is everything's on the table again. And that could mean Stevens loses his job on the outside. It could mean they move him back to the back end or whatever.
Yeah. Yeah. And I think what they've done is they've given themselves some versatility and some options and some different ways to do things. You're absolutely correct, by the way. It was the London game against the Titans where he played, I think it was about 13 snaps as a deep safety, okay, which would have been, that was the Hamilton ejection.
Right. Okay. I actually had forgotten that the Hamilton ejection was in London, but that puts the pieces together. I appreciate you looking that up. What else we want to talk about? Bad game to lose the snap count, 74-54. They're playing with four IDLs again. I feel like I've been yelling till I'm blue in the face that this is really poor risk management. I cannot believe that one additional special teams player is worth the risk you take by being one short on the defensive line. The Ravens have now been burned by it twice. And in this game, even though they still got some pressure, all four of the sacks, coincidentally, were completed two plays before Travis Jones got hurt. And then Travis Jones came back and he was just a shadow of who he'd been in that first half.
I think as well, like I think it would be infuriating, or like the risk wouldn't necessarily be worth the reward if everyone on the defensive line was healthy. But the fact that Travis Jones has dealt with an injury throughout the season
means that
the four, you're probably already actually only at 3.5.
Yep.
And, you know, against a team that the Ravens should know exactly what type of game they're going to have against the Steelers, because it doesn't matter who's playing quarterback. It doesn't matter if it's backups. It's almost always the same type of game between the two of them. So I thought the same thing when I saw the the inactives. I thought they were very light in the defensive front.
The Steelers know exactly what to do with that too. They're a team that knows to lean on. I think they put on a sixth offensive lineman a bunch, forced the Ravens into the base package. The Ravens even had four defensive linemen on the field for two different plays in this game. So it was a odd mix of stuff, but we do want to get back to the offense here. I apologize for this. these things, they're betrayed on Lamar was betrayed on several different plays by the wide receivers in this game. I guess we kind of hit on this, the likely fumble. We talked a little bit, the Hill interception. It was a good play again. The Flowers drop was kind of a weird situation where Flowers had his hands open to make what appeared to be a body catch and not up and in the diamond formation looking for the ball. I'm just wondering, you know, Dad, if you watch this play a number of times, do you think it's a case of he underestimated Lamar's arm strength or got caught in the middle of two things? And I did get a explanation from Qadri Ishmael, which I really appreciate on this. But I just wanted to, if you have some thoughts on it first, I'll.
Yeah. So first part on the actual catch point part of it as well, I hadn't really considered it, but as you were talking through it there, I feel like, and this is purely anecdotally, on scramble drills, I feel like you see more body catches whereby like the receivers are kind of coming back to the ball. Mm-hmm. The quarterback isn't necessarily always pinpoint on those. So you are, rather than trying to go and get it. But that's purely anecdotal in that. The other part I thought that was interesting about that play was that Flowers was actually open far earlier in the play, mm-hmm. and Lamar just didn't get there. So that was one of those ones whereby I think the early part of the play, there was a Lamar miss, and then he actually puts the ball exactly where it needs to go, and it's just an infuriating failed catch, effectively.
It's one of the worst places you can get hit is right there on your clavicle or wherever it was, or you know, maybe the very bottom of his helmet. Qadri sent me it was really nice. He sent me about a 5-minute voicemail that described like what the receiver might be going through on this. And he said, he might have tried to body catch it, but that's not really his preferred style. He said Flowers is more of a hands catcher. I'm trying to remember. Flowers had the game-winning catch against Dallas when the Ravens needed a first down, and I think they got to third and six or so, or I don't remember the exact yardage. Flowers caught the ball, and my recollection, if you want to even bring it up on All 22 or something, is that it was a body catch. But I don't remember it being a hand catch. I kind of remember him leaping slightly for the ball, completely collapsing over it, and making that catch by that right sideline. Just visual memory.
Yeah, that's what I don't have it up just now, but that's what I remember as well. It was like that type of, at least kind of like clutching into it type thing, yeah, rather than going in and wearing it with his hands.
Beetle grabbing of the ball.
Yeah. Yeah.
So, you know, it could have worked out there, but if it was to work out, he would have had to jump on that play. And that was the other point he made, is that he probably got distracted by the other things that were happening around him, including what he had to do after the catch, trying to figure out where the DB was and all that. So, it was nice. But Q, thank you very much for sending me that. I really appreciate the effort and the long description you gave me. All right. What else we want to talk about? About the standard amount of yards after the catch relative to total yards. That's one thing I've been looking at this year, because Lamar's had been doing better at throwing the ball further downfield, relying less on his receivers to make yards. He had an 11.1 ADOT, but he was nowhere near that. And I don't remember if that's the ADOT I got from Next Gen or from PFF. That might be the PFF one, because I think the Next Gen one is actually somewhat shorter. It's like 9 yards and change. So there's probably some different definition of how you guys measure it. But in either case, it was way short of that the average catch was, which Lamar had been pretty good in recent weeks in particular, being a pretty close distinction between ADOT and the yards at the catch.
Yeah, that's an interesting point, actually. I hadn't considered that. Yeah, we had it at 10.8. So yeah, 11.
Very close.
11 was okay. Yeah.
Okay. You know, I think a hidden problem with the Ravens is they're now 19 out of 49 on third down in the last four games. So that's only slightly under 40%, I guess. Not what you would hope from a high-powered offense, but they're much more about explosive than they are like the 2019 Ravens in terms of a, being a grinding, take the life out of the defense, kind of a four downs and a and 11 yards kind of offense.
So I haven't looked into this. Is there, what was it in terms of like down in distance? Like, was it a lot of longer third downs, or was it more kind of all over the place?
That is a really good question, and I don't have that information. I don't think they had a lot of short ones, though. I don't think they
I don't remember there being that many short ones.
Yeah, and you know, that is a really important contextual thing. It might not be terrible because they weren't awful in this game. They were 4 of 11, so 36%. So it can be, that might be a good number if you're averaging, you know, 7 or 8 yards, or if you're, if your general texture of the thing had a lot of longer ones. They did have all those penalties, so I know they did have some.
Didn't you know it's possible to get THC shipped right to your door? Mood delivers premium 100% federally legal THC directly to you. I'm talking about delicious, high-potency gummies, top-shelf flower, home-baked cookies, vapes, anything you'd find at a dispensary, you can now order online and have it shipped quickly, discreetly, and conveniently right to your door. And every Mood product is made from pesticide-free cannabis grown on America's best small farms at prices that won't destroy your wallet. Best of all, not only is every Mood product backed by a 100-day satisfaction guarantee, but as I mentioned, listeners get 20% off their first order with code RAVENS. So head to mood.com/ravens, check out their online dispensary, and let Mood help you discover your perfect mood. And don't forget to use promo code RAVENS when you check out to save 20% on your first order.
Men, if you've lost your hair, it doesn't mean you can't find it again. Try Hims Hair Loss Solutions and you'll be joining hundreds of thousands of subscribers who found their hair again. It can be hard for men to deal with hair loss, even though it is common. Luckily, I'm here to provide you with a solution so you don't even have to talk about it. Through Hims, you can restore your hair by accessing their personalized hair loss solutions. Men value many different things about their appearance. But if you're a guy who really cares about your hair and find that it's slowly going away, you might be feeling discouraged when you look in the mirror. And that's where Hims comes in. Check out their personalized hair loss solutions, and you can start seeing your hair grow back in as little as 3 to 6 months. Hims provides you with convenient access to a range of hair loss treatments that work, all from the comfort of your couch. Hims makes treating hair loss simple with doctor-trusted options and clinically proven ingredients, like finasteride and minoxidil that can regrow hair in as little as 3 to 6 months. Choose from personalized chewable, oral, spray, and serum treatments to find what works best for you. The process is simple and 100% online, so there are no uncomfortable doctor visits. Answer a few questions, and a medical provider will determine if treatment is right for you. If prescribed, your treatment is sent directly to you for free. No insurance is needed, and one low price covers everything from treatments to ongoing care. Hims has hundreds of thousands of trusted subscribers, and they can help you get your confidence back too with visibly thicker and fuller hair. Start your free online visit today at hims.com/Hail Mary. That's hims.com/Hail Mary for your personalized hair loss treatment options. hims.com/Hail Mary. Results may vary based on studies of topical and oral minoxidil and finasteride. Prescription products require an online consultation with a healthcare provider who will determine if a prescription is appropriate. Restrictions apply. See website for full details and important safety information.
Shopify is a global commerce platform that helps you sell at every stage of your business. And sell more with less effort thanks to the Shopify Magic, your AI-powered all-star. Sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/redcircle, all lowercase. Go to shopify.com/redcircle now to grow your business, no matter what stage you're in. Shopify.com/redcircle.
This time of year, a good hoodie is absolutely essential. But these days, it's tough to find one that will last through the season. That's why the American Giant Classic Full Zip Hoodie is made to last a lifetime, so you can count on it to bring you comfort and warmth year after year. Slate Magazine called it the greatest hoodie ever made. And from cotton to zipper, it's made right here in the USA. It's crafted with timeless style, heavyweight fleece, a double-lined hood, and reinforced elbow patches, which means this hoodie can withstand any outing or adventure. It'll be your new favorite hoodie, and you can depend on it for years to come. Plus, buying from American Giant means supporting local communities of farmers, manufacturers, and more. This season, snag the hoodie that will bring you comfort for life, the American Giant Classic Full Zip, and save 20% off your first order at American-Giant.com when you use code CLASSIC24 at checkout. That's 20% off your first order at American-Giant.com. Code CLASSIC24.
The NFL playoffs are better with FanDuel because right now new customers can bet $5 and get $200 in bonus bets. Guaranteed. That's $200 in bonus bets, win or lose. FanDuel, an official sportsbook partner of the NFL. 21 plus and present in select states. First online real money wager only. $5 first deposit required. Bonus issued as non-withdrawable bonus bets which expire 7 days after receipt. Restrictions apply. See terms at sportsbook.fanduel.com. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER.
That were not particularly good. 16 points and 16 first downs, both season lows. Nothing to like about that.
It's not great.
They still lead the NFL in average first downs per game, which is surprising because I thought Detroit would have overtaken them this week with the big game they had, but they didn't. Detroit, what they have run into is the lead now in points per drive, which is probably the most important offensive statistic if you're talking at a team level.
Yeah, a bad week for the Ravens to have a rough week on offense when the Lions go in and just score pretty much every time they touch the ball against the Jaguars.
Little bit of difference in opponent there. Now, what still was working out for the Ravens was the red zone opportunities. They have not dropped the ball on. They're up to now 77, well, 7 out of every 9 red zone opportunities they've cashed in on. 5.98 points per red zone drive. That's almost a touchdown, folks, for every red zone drive. Cincinnati is second at 5.64. And they're at only 69.7%. So they're 8 full percentage points ahead of the number 2 team in red zone percentage, which I find to be pretty incredible.
That really is incredible. I as well, and again, this part is more anecdotal than definite fact. The heading into this game, I felt like the Ravens seemed to have had a tendency this season, especially as the season had gone on, whereby they had got really good at kind of like growing into the game on offense as well, whereby it felt like they got into the second half and like you couldn't stop them scoring, right? They were going to finish off pretty much every single drive.
All right, let's talk about a little bit about Lamar. He did have a couple of nice design runs. I did not notice a case where he scrambled and made a big play. And I may be wrong about that. Maybe I missed something, but there's one play that was cut off on the TV. I had to look at the All-22 to finally get it. And then, of course, I don't have the timing information I need. But he ran left right off the snap, and they picked it up, and he's 10 yards downfield.
Yeah, it was. It was just – and I we had it on in the office, and – so I didn't see the initial thing until I looked on social media and saw that apparently they were talking about like a blimp or something before it, and then they just cut back and Lamar's 10 yards downfield already.
Yeah, they had a shot down, I guess it was from the blimp that they were looking at, or maybe it was from a drone. I'm not sure what they use these days. It seems like a blimp is a big expense to go to, but then we've had those stoppages in play when there's a drone. I want to talk a little bit about this. We talked a little bit about the Steelers' false steps, but they really loaded up on heavier numbers in this game. They had 18 plays where they rushed 4, and they really held the Ravens down on those plays, only 3.1 yards per play. They had a sack, a turnover on those. When they rushed 5, that was 8 times, 8.4 yards per play. When they rushed 6, which is still 7 more times, they allowed 5.7 yards per play. It did have an interception among those. And then when they rushed 7, they had one play for 42 yards. That was a big play to Likely on the right sideline fairly early in the game. I think it might have led to the first missed field goal, right?
Yeah, I think that was the second drive, I think, because they were moving the ball pretty well.
But what that averages out to is 4.7 pass rushers per play, which is a bodaciously high number. Teams basically never get to 5. That would mean you're basically rushing 6 more than you're rushing 4. And that just doesn't really happen ever in the NFL. I guess It probably could. If we went back to that Miami game in 2021, it might have something like that. But that's a very, very high number. And that really led to a huge amount of set and chip blocking in the game. The Ravens used 39 eligible receiver blocks. I meant to ask you this. So I saw 39, and I know the breakdown is 15 and 24 as I scored it. Do you have a breakdown of the number of scored pass blocking plays by eligible receivers in the game for the Ravens?
Yes, there should actually be a way for me to check that, because we do have, like, within the game and, like, individual. The only thing I'm not 100% certain on with that actually is for a chip. A chip, would they then go out into the pattern? We do have that somewhere. I don't know if we have that within premium stats, for example.
I'd like to see if you look at the pass blocking for PFF, and I could bring this up too. I know how to get there, I guess. But if you look at all the eligible receiver positions, and that number is 15 exactly, or maybe it's 19 or something, which means we have some further definitional difference between a set and a chip. But a chip, anytime, even like very late in the play, that he releases and clearly gives up on the block and starts looking for the ball, I would consider a chip block.
Yeah. I'm looking in just now, and within the premium stats part, we've got running backs and tight ends, and I'm getting to 14.
So it's 14. Okay.
Yeah.
So it might have been something I called a set block that you guys did not. So it's close anyway. It's in the ballpark, but it's obviously just definitional. Now, I think we need to get to the part that I think is most frustrating about this game, is that I did think the Steelers frustrated Lamar with the numbers that gave him some trouble, even though what really came out of this is he had a lot of time to throw. First of all, I'm going to toss out that one sack that I think was a run play. So that of 34 total passes plus sacks that were in the game, 17 of those he had ample time and space on, which is half the time he had a 3-second pocket. He went 7 of 17 on those plays, which is terrible for having a 3-second pocket, and for 121 yards, which is bad at 7.1 yards per play. Now there were a couple plays in there where things didn't go right for him. I think the drop was included in there, and also the interception that was pried away from Hill was there, which should have been, you know, a substantial gain on that play. I don't remember what 15 yards or so maybe it would have been.
Yeah, I think it might even be more than that. I think it was one of those wheelers. Maybe it wasn't as long as I suspected. I thought as well, like, one of the things I think the Steelers are really good at doing with Lamar is speeding up his processing. So, like, giving him more stuff to think about or I guess maybe technically what I'm saying is actually, like, slowing it down. So giving him more to think about, like, from the snap to when he wants to get the ball out. And the way the Steelers set up coverage-wise, they are, they're more susceptible to be beaten kind of down on the outside, which requires a little bit more time, a little bit more patience from the quarterback. And it's also where the Ravens aren't great, like, at their skill set and receiver, right? They're Flowers and Bateman are not the kind of prototypical X that will go up and win the ball.
And we also had another failure in this game that Charles Davis called out immediately for Deontay Johnson not creating space to the outside of the field. Yeah,
exactly. And I think what the Steelers were able to do by giving Lamar, like, more to think about and almost more to worry about in terms of expecting pressure to come in there, is that on some of those downfield throws, he just wasn't comfortable and set. He was kind of on kind of uneven feet, and I think that led to some inaccurate passes.
Yeah, no, I agree. Underperformed his opportunity set in this game by about 14 yards. Again, I'm using a static number that maybe needs to be revised, but I have him for about 219 expected, and he had 205 net yards. So about half a yard, 0.4 yards below his expectation on a per play basis. Now, they did really well against Wilson. They held Wilson almost a yard below, 39 yards below on 40 dropbacks. So they kind of won that exchange, but when you have Lamar Jackson and you're holding him to the same standard as Wilson, you want a little bit better payoff than that in terms of what's going on.
Absolutely.
Okay, 3.45 seconds average time to throw for Jackson. And most of that in this game, I would say, was not like some sort of wasted time where he's being chased around the pocket continuously. And, you know, there's 4 seconds where he couldn't even possibly have thrown the ball. or even, you know, 6 seconds spread out over all the passes. I thought most of that time was time where he could have thrown a pass. And for that reason, I thought it wasn't a good game of Lamar making use of the time and space he had.
Yeah, I think overall, it's a weird game whereby as good, and I think this probably speaks to how good the Ravens were in defense in the game, that any number of maybe five plays goes the opposite way and the Ravens probably win the game. You know, the field goals, the fumbles and all those things. But Lamar just was never comfortable in this game, it felt like. And I think that just led to a lot of misses, and not just misses on throws, but there were also just misses that he had that players were open. Right, like I was spending some time like going through the film today, and on it might even been that Deontay Johnson play where he doesn't create enough space. I think it might be DeMonte KZ, number 25 for the Steelers, slips, and Zay Flowers is wide open and probably falls down.
That was on the right sideline, right?
I think he started on the left and came in. Oh wait, sorry, do you mean Deontay Johnson on the right?
No. Deontay Johnson was the one I'm talking about. Deontay Johnson not making space, definitely on the left sideline, right down by the pylon, and the ball. He led him out of bounds, but he could have had room to lead him if Deontay Johnson had created that space.
Yeah,
what I'm talking about for Flowers was on the right sideline, and neither the defensive back nor Flowers seemed to track the ball particularly well, and it went over Flowers' outside shoulder and landed in play.
So on the Deontay Johnson play, Zay Flowers is running like an in on that play. I think from the slot, it must have been just based on where he was lined up. And DeMonte KZ just slips and falls down. Huh. And if Lamar had got there, Flowers catches the ball and walks in for about a 25-yard touchdown. Now, I don't, based on progressions on that, it's completely acceptable that he throws the ball to Deontay Johnson and there is a play there to be made. It's just one of those things whereby, watching it back over the all 22, if that throw isn't made, then you know there is another opportunity there for a big play.
I saw something come up on Twitter that related to, it was reported by PFF that had turnover worthy plays, and I thought, you know, we have you on the show, this is the best time for you to explain what's a turnover worthy play as PFF defines it.
Yeah, so turnover worthy plays are exclusively in the passing game. So it's not exclusively a turnover-worthy throw, because a turnover-worthy play would also be on a bad holding of the ball on a sack that leads to something, or like a fumble and a scramble and stuff like that. But effectively, it is a play whereby there should be a turnover that is the quarterback's fault on a passing play. So the obvious ones are dropped interceptions. I think I kind of touched on it a little bit earlier. The interception, as it currently stands for Lamar in this game, isn't classed as a turnover-worthy throw for us. Mm-hmm. I can't even remember. I'd need to go and look and see. My initial thought, if I was grading the game, is I would have probably downgraded Lamar, because I think, actually, I probably wouldn't. It would have probably been like a zero-graded play. But I think you can blame him a little bit for the play not being completed, because it's underthrown. But it's not underthrown to the point that it should be picked. That's just a Justice Hill not being able to hang on to the ball and a really nice play by Peyton Wilson.
Right. All right. That's good. And Lamar was at 1.3% for the year, which is about one every 70 to 80 in that range.
Yeah.
Yeah. Exceptionally good, but I guess one of the things that comes up out of this, Allen had a game. Allen beat the Chiefs, of course. Didn't have his best game. You know, he had a solid game. He had a great run play in there. Mediocre kind of a passer rating game. And now he's jumped way up front of Lamar in terms of the MVP voting. What do you? I'm not really bothered by this, honestly, right now. I'm just surprised at the fickleness of the bettors and the markets that are out there.
So I think this is one of those situations whereby the reaction is the reaction from the average fan to the odds change is probably different. It almost definitely is different than the reasoning behind the odds shift. So I think people look at that and they go, oh, Lamar lost this weekend. Josh Allen had the big game, the big win against the Chiefs. All of a sudden, he leapfrogs them there. I think it's more likely that the reason for the odds shift is because of the odds shift or the probability of the Ravens winning the division.
Yeah.
Because it's harder for you to win MVP when you don't go and win that. I did see, like, about 10 minutes before hopping on here, Emmanuel Acho with a thing on FS1 whereby he's talking about how, you know, last year they dinged Josh Allen for losing games. And, you know, Lamar Jackson didn't really have good enough stats last year, but it was because they won games that he was the MVP. It's going to really annoy me when this season plays out, and or even 5 years from now, but it'll start from this year, when we just start pretending that Lamar wasn't the best quarterback in the NFL last year and wasn't the most valuable player in the NFL. Like, it wasn't a year where you had, like, someone like Lamar in 2019, whereby it was this tremendous season, but I think he was still comfortably the most valuable.
Let me challenge you a little bit, because you're one of the few people who's probably in a position to steer the wheel to make sure that Lamar gets the credit he deserves. And the basic problem is, and this is, I think Aaron Schatz blew his MVP vote last year because he was the one dissenter because of this specific fact, is that it's very hard to quantify how much Lamar is improving all the other players around him by his presence. You have to account for him. You can see it in success rates, for example, by running backs. Gus Edwards, of all people, is the all-time leader in success rate for running backs. It doesn't make any sense other than Lamar Jackson is the only plausible solution to that. And look at all the other players who are on that leaderboard, which is only covers the last 30 years, but, you know, 6 or 7 of the top 15 are Ravens.
Yeah.
And it doesn't make any sense if it's not Lamar.
My favorite personal bit that I've developed this year is just taking stats that are running back stats, that are offensive line stats, and just quoting it with, like, this is actually a Lamar Jackson stat. There was one that we posted on our fantasy account, and I think it might have been yards before contact for Derrick Henry. And I was like, this is actually a Lamar Jackson stat, because that's where that comes in. And like, that's where time and time again, you see a stat come up, and people have done the same thing this year. Like, oh, you know, Lamar Jackson's been carried by, not being carried by, but, like, he's got the support and help of Derrick Henry. And I, like I said earlier, I think there is an element whereby Henry does have a similar ability to take focus away, just on a far smaller scale, because just based on, like, the positional value on those things. But just the idea that it's not still Lamar Jackson that is significantly driving those things is a little bit silly, I think.
All right. Well, I completely agree. You've got some of the smartest people in the world in your R&D department at across PFF, but in the R&D department for sure. And Timo in particular imputes all sorts of values for draft picks and whatnot into dollars. And I mean, it's really very good reasoning for it. It's whether it's the exact right model in the end, it's a great place to start in terms of the methodology. I bet he could find a way to impute that value somehow, or come up with a model to do it. In fact, I'm going to give you two projects to take home for Timo, because here's the other one. I want Timo to spend time, always spending Timo's time for him, that's a bad idea, finding out what's the relative value of a penalty in terms of EPA, including the value of the option. So it's easy to see the EPA of a play when it is accepted, when it is declined, you just have the value of the play shows up. But the hard part is including maybe the value of that option too. And we talked about, this was one of the things when I was in London, we talked about how I think PFF has a significant underweight on penalties, in particularly relative to other offensive line play. Where it's, you know, the penalty is all a part of one offensive lineman, where, you know, if Derrick Henry runs for 15 yards and it's the opposite sign but the same absolute value of, say, EPA for a play as a holding call is, there's 6 or 7 players that have their hand out asking for a share of that value.
Yeah, that's fair. Yeah. That is an interesting way to look at it.
Yeah, I would love for Timo is just the kind of guy who'd be able to figure that out. I'll contact him directly. It's bad for me to send you to do that, but All right, let's talk running backs a little bit. Hill had 30 carries, Henry 30, Mitchell 2. One in Pony, which I actually missed. I did not see the play that was Pony. Was Mitchell wide, or were they both in the backfield together?
I don't think I saw it either, so I don't think I know exactly what one it was.
Right. Well, it's 62 total snaps for the running backs and 61 for the quarterback, so I think it had to be there. I just don't know when it was. And I guess it could have been something like when they knelt at the end of the half. They had Mitchell in some sort of safety role there, but
yeah, potentially
could be something like that where I wouldn't have been on top of it. Let's see. Are you surprised at all that Keaton Mitchell has touched the ball so little since he's come back?
Knowing when he was coming back, if you told me that at this point he had touched the ball as much as he had, I would be surprised. Mm-hmm. I feel like when I've seen him touch the ball on kick returns, I feel like he's not all the way back yet. So I think that probably is having an impact on his opportunities. And like Justice Hill continues to make himself valuable to what the Ravens want to do, and his ability to be my take that I had a couple of weeks ago was that if you had the NFL equivalent of the sixth man award through the first 10 weeks of the season, I think you can make a pretty good case that Justice Hill is one of the best sixth men in the NFL because of how good he's been as a receiver and doing some things in the blocking game as well.
So it's like a sixth skill position player on a team where you have a big five and then you have one kind of thing. Okay. I do think Hill's in a little bit of a slump now. If I look at his, you know, yards per carry, yards per reception, yards per target. He hasn't been very good the last few weeks. He's very important and kind of, I think, underappreciated as a blocker because he has to do some amazingly difficult things as the last line of defense for this Ravens team. Whereas with other teams, I think, if his role was primarily chipping on plays we saw where it's either Watt or Herbig and he has to just launch himself into the midsection and then go, that'd be much less of a thing. But they haven't been there set blocking a lot. He had two sets and five chips in this game. The guy they really relied on this game for set blocking was Ricard, who had seven. Yeah. All right. Ravens getting lighter and lighter by week, it seems. Now, some of that may be the Deontay's Johnson acquisition, but they did have their four tight ends back healthy this week as opposed to likely being out last week. They're down to 1.62 heavies, which I think is still a high number for the NFL. I don't think, you know, there are many teams who play as much extra tight end fullback OL6 as the Ravens do, but it's still surprising to me that the Ravens get lighter in a game maybe like this. There was some game script stuff, and I know the end drive, they had to get down the field and score. It's still kind of a little surprising to me.
And I think as well, like it relates into the inactives on the interior defensive line as well. Like it is strange that for a game like this, the Ravens left themselves a little bit light on the interior defensive line, and also kind of weren't willing to meet the Steelers in that way on offense as well.
So your point is they should have tried to shorten the game on their side just to reduce the burden on their own defensive line.
Yeah, and also just like stylistically, like knowing the type of game it would be. I guess maybe you're actually trying to go against the Steelers' strengths. You know, the Steelers are really strong in the interior defensive line and just the defensive line in general. And knowing what the Ravens have in the offensive line, maybe you expect that you're going to struggle there and you want to do those things. But yeah, the option to be able to try and shorten things on your end, but also just knowing that you're probably going to be in for a bit of a dogfight, to me would have lent itself to some more heavier sets.
Mm-hmm. All right. Johnson only 11 snaps. He's you know, one of the things about this, he's played 33 snaps since he got here. He's had four targets, one catch for 6 yards, and that's in three games. Those same games, Wallace and Aguilar have gotten significantly more playing time than him. So he's the true WR5 on this team right now. And I know he's more an insurance policy than he is a current talent. But a lot was made at the time that he was acquired that the Ravens need his ability to bust free in man coverage, adding another not maybe quite at the Flowers level, but another sudden athlete who can break free and get separation. Did the PFF separation metrics bear that out?
He was like coming into the trade. I haven't looked at where it's been since he got to the Ravens, but when the Ravens acquired him, that meant that they had three of the top 20 separators among all wide receivers and tight ends. So I'll need to go and look and see where it's been beyond that, where it's been since he arrived. When they made the move, though, I didn't necessarily expect much more than this, because I thought it was the insurance policy for if one of Flowers or Bateman, in particular Flowers, goes down, that you want that other. I don't think they want to be in a position whereby they're relying on Nelson Agholor as wide receiver two.
Right. Or Tylan Wallace, who's been great in his very, very limited opportunities, has also been fine there. He fits into the role. It fits in exactly the thing of he's a name wide receiver who's had a ton of targets. He's logged a bunch of yards in some years. He's logged a bunch of targets in some years, and he's never really had a great yards per target season. So he's over eight once. That might have been 2 years ago with Pittsburgh, I think. And he's the rest of his career, for his career as a whole, for example, he's at 6.8 yards per target. That's just not exciting in a receiver. And I know there are some. There's some things playing with Roethlisberger at the end of his career, and then with a series of other clowns at quarterback in Carolina and Pittsburgh, it might not have been that good a situation for him. I just think that's an overcorrection to make that guy into a good receiver.
Yeah, and I certainly know, like from talking to some Steelers fans, I know that like when they traded him for the Dante Jackson, I think the cornerback with the Panthers, they weren't particularly bothered about losing him. And they also weren't particularly bothered when the Ravens acquired him. They didn't seem to have any worry of for a revenge game and stuff like that. So, like, I think he's been overhyped as a receiver throughout this time in the NFL, and he wasn't particularly effective in Carolina when he was there.
I did want to talk to you about one other thing, and I've been really interested in the tackles. Tackles forced a lot on offense in particular, but also the tackling on the defensive side as well. And the Ravens and Steelers met in this game as the two best tackling teams in the entire NFL by several different metrics. And I use PFF missed tackles divided by total tackle attempts, meaning the tackles plus the assists, yeah, plus the missed tackles. And also, in terms of the grade, I think they were 1 and 2. But now that this game happened and the Ravens did not force a bunch of missed tackles, and that's the DNA of this team, is to force a lot of missed tackles, both from your receivers and from Derrick Henry, from Justice Hill as a receiver for that matter. How serious a concern is that, that the Ravens had, lost that part of the game by so much, or is it a hidden concern to you at all?
It's not a huge concern to me, because I think it's a stylistic thing, and I don't think there are that many teams that the Ravens would struggle to force missed tackles against. And in spite of their inability to force missed tackles, if you replay this game 10 times, I think the Ravens probably win 7 of them. Okay. Just based on those things. And maybe I'm discounting the Steelers a little bit too much there. But I think they'll still be able to force missed tackles against other teams. And realistically, I think they can beat the Steelers in other ways when they play them again.
I mean, I look at it as there were 9 field goal attempts in this game, and only one of them got the desired result for the Ravens. I think if you replayed that 100 times, I doubt you'd end up with the Steelers winning in more than 3. I think, Boswell has to go 6 for 6 with several kicks over 50 yards. I don't know whether it was 2 or might have even been 3, but it was probably 2. And then Tucker's got to miss 2 out of 3. Again, for you to lose the game, even if you go 6 for 6. So all you need is 2 to go your way. Yeah. All right. Well, that's going to have to do it for the first part of this show. It is always just such a pleasure to have you on, Gordon. Tell folks where they can contact you online if they have questions. I know you love dealing with Twitter, Ravens discussion, and how can they contact you?
Yeah, you'll find me on Twitter, PFF_Gordon. I also have added a Blue Sky account, seeing as a lot of the football accounts have moved over there. So I think I'm just GordonMCG on there. If you search for my name, you'll find me. And yeah, I do. Like, I love having people reach out to me. I did a Seattle radio show a month ago now, and the host on there was like, you know, you work at PFF and you're in this, you know, it's a company that covers the whole of the NFL. I noticed that you tweet a lot about Lamar Jackson. Like, what's the kind of reason for that? And I just had to be like, well, like, you know, I'm not actually a writer at PFF. I'm kind of in charge of what our content strategy is. My social media is kind of just like what interests me. And I grew up a Baltimore Ravens fan. So I like talking about the Ravens like that. My social media account is effectively my Ravens blog for like general musings and general discussions with people. So anytime anyone wants to reach out to me, I'm more than happy to.
Did you do some writing in the past for PFF, or have you always been kind of a strategy guy like that?
So I still even do some writing now. I actually had a conversation with someone just around like career development today. Like, I was offering someone some advice, and the way I would describe it is like, I can write listicles. I can't write long form. It's just not, you know, I didn't go and study that. So where I am is I can write, if you need me to write four sentences to use PFF grades to explain why someone's good, can do that, no problem at all. But the rest of the time I'll focus on the kind of strategy type things.
I personally love that kind of content. I think it's extremely illuminating to do that kind of thing. I think in some ways my articles kind of come across that way. I also love the Timo kind of articles where he goes through an entire way to lay out a methodology. I think he does a very good job of that. But general, the PFF content is really good. When you see something be posted from that, and particularly if Gordon will be hyping it somehow, it's probably worth reading. It's probably worth at least taking a chance on reading it. Whereas a lot of others, as soon as I see expert encourages Ravens to trade for something, I know it's going to be complete crap, because it's going to be some sort of thing has a bunch of ads in it. And they basically want me to scroll through about six paragraphs to find out that the author thinks that the Ravens ought to trade for some cornerback. I'm not looking for that. And that's not the kind of stuff you get from PFF. I've also been enjoying a little bit watching, like I said, Sam and Sam, right? On do the show.
Sam and Steve, yeah.
Oh, Steve Palazzolo. Okay, right.
Yeah.
Okay. Do their prediction shows, although they seem to be very pro Bengal from what I can tell on their show. I don't know if either of them is a Bengal fan. So
No, they definitely aren't. And they are. They're still doing. So they went off. They're now no longer at BFF, but we still have a pretty good relationship with them. They're still doing their show out of the studio in Cincinnati.
Oh, okay. I just assumed that was part of PFF, that show. But okay, very good. All right. Other folks out there, if you'd like to be on a film study short, bye week's coming up, outstanding time to get in. Hit me up with a DM. They're always open on Twitter with an idea. All I want is about three bullet points on what you'd like to talk about. And we'll have time for a couple shows over that bye week. Gordon, thanks again for coming on.
Thank you very much.
And we'll talk to you next time on Film Study.
The NFL playoffs are better with FanDuel, because right now new customers can bet $5 and get $200 in bonus bets, guaranteed. That's $200 in bonus bets, win or lose. FanDuel, an official sportsbook partner of the NFL. 21 plus and present in select states. First online real money wager only. $5 first deposit required. Bonus issued as non-withdrawable bonus bets, which expire 7 days after receipt. Restrictions apply. See terms at sportsbook.fanduel.com. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER.
Ladies and gentlemen, we are now boarding Group A. Please have your boarding passes ready to scan. If your phone is cracked, old, or was chewed up by your Chihuahua travel companion, please refrain from holding up the line. And instead, simply go to Verizon and trade in any phone in any condition from one of their top brands for the new Samsung Galaxy S25 Plus with Galaxy AI on Unlimited Ultimate and Watch or Tap, also on them.
Service plan required for Watch or Tap. Trade in and additional terms apply. See Verizon.com for details.
At Kroger, an annual Boost membership just got even better. Now you can choose from Disney Plus with ads, Hulu with ads, or ESPN Plus on us when you sign up. Plus, enjoy unlimited free delivery, double fuel points, exclusive offers, and free items. Sign up for a Boost membership today. It's an easier way to save, including new streaming options to relax with while we deliver your groceries. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Restrictions apply. See site for details.